from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. On Monday, President Obama's health care reform law goes on trial in the United States Supreme Court. The law was passed 2 years ago today, and lower courts have issued rulings both upholding and striking down the law. Now it's the Supreme Court's turn. In the hour ahead, we'll explore what impact the law has had so far here in California, and then we'll turn to the legal arguments. What aspects of the law are being challenged, and what justices will play pivotal roles? The court takes on health care. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. During his 2005 confirmation hearing, the current Chief Justice, John Roberts, famously compared the job of a judge to an umpire who calls balls and strikes. Now, 7 years later, the Roberts Court will decide if President Obama's health care law gets tossed or remains in the game. The Supreme Court begins its deliberation on Monday with an extraordinary 3-day hearing. We'll spend most of our hour today previewing the legal arguments before the court, but we want to ground that discussion first by hearing something about the impact the law has had so far here in California. Joining us first to provide that, Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED's The California Report. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
California has been fairly aggressive in getting the law underway. Some 49 of the 50 states have started. California's pushed pretty aggressively on this. One of the things that's happened so far is making people who are had not been eligible to stay on their parents' care once they turned a certain age, to extend that out. What's happened with that? How many young people now can get care by way of their parents?
Well, that particular provision of the law actually is in effect in all 50 states. So while it's true that California has really charged ahead with the implementation, some of these federal provisions are in effect everywhere. So as you mentioned, children up to age 26 can be on their parents' plan. It used to be that kids, if as long as they were dependents, technically dependents of their parents, could stay on a parent's plan up to various ages in different states. But now that exemption is taken away. So young people who have jobs oftentimes don't work in positions that come with benefits, so they can stay on their parents' insurance plan.
Whether or not you're in school, that part of
exactly,
it is,
that
has
part
gone
is
away.
Has gone away, exactly.
And one of the other things that's already in effect is pre-existing conditions. Tell us who has a pre-existing condition, who can now automatically get health care, but who still cannot.
Yeah, so this has been a big issue. So right now, what is in effect is that children cannot be denied for a pre-existing condition. So regardless of if they were born with a heart murmur or they have asthma or they have acne, as we saw in some cases before this went into effect, the insurance companies have to actually offer them a plan. That pre-existing condition exclusion is not in effect yet for adults. That will go into effect in 2014. So in 2014, the insurance companies will not be able to deny adults a plan if they have a pre-existing condition.
But here in California, and perhaps everywhere, a child can no longer be denied for that reason?
That's exactly right. And that's true in all 50 states.
Now, where California is, I think, as I understand it, moving more aggressively is in beginning to plan for what will come into effect later on, starting with these things called healthcare exchanges. If you can, tell us what those are and where California is at in that process.
Sure. So California was the first state to pass exchange legislation. So this is essentially the marketplace. And the way to think about it for most of us is going to be this online marketplace. So this website where you'll be able to go, it'll be a little bit like Travelocity. According to both some federal rules and then some state rules that are being designed, there'll be certain types of health insurance packages. There'll be a platinum, a gold, a silver, and a bronze. And the idea is that, you know, right now it's very difficult, even if you go to ehealthinsurance.com or something like that. It's very hard to know really what's in the plan. People often buy this insurance, and then sure enough, they find out that something about, you know, their right toe has been excluded. So the idea with these, with sort of standardizing the plans, is that you'll know what you're buying ahead of time. So the insurance exchange will be a place where you'll be able to go, and the insurance companies, instead of competing based on cherry picking, essentially, which is what they've done up until now.
Well, meaning really, picking the healthier
people. Yeah. Now they're going to have to compete on price, and they're going to have to compete on quality.
And how far along is California in getting that exchange set up? And when would they have to, if the law remains in effect, if the Supreme Court keeps it in effect, when do they have to be ready for that?
So according to the federal law, all 50 states will have to have some exchange up and running as of January 1st, 2014. In states like California, if all goes according to plan, California's exchange will go online on January 1st, 2014. People will be able to go on and sign up. The big thing about the exchanges is this is where the government subsidies come in. So right now, if you're quite poor, but typically you have to be disabled or have children in the household or be a child yourself, you can qualify for Medi-Cal. But there's this middle ground, right, of people who can earn up to, I think it's about $92,000 for a family of four, where you'll go onto the exchange and you can actually qualify for a government subsidy to help you buy a private insurance plan.
So how much resource has gone into this kind of planning? Is this involving lots of people at the state level, the insurance companies? I mean, how much work has already been put in to get this underway?
There's been a lot of work to get it to where it is right now. So essentially what they're doing is they're kind of building the scaffolding for this thing. So you've actually got a health insurance exchange board that's been appointed. They've been meeting for, gosh, I think more than a year now. The insurance companies have been up in Sacramento constantly working, as have consumer advocates, working with the board to try and come up with the rules of the road, if you will. They've just put out the RFP, the request for proposal, to IT companies who can bid on actually building this thing. So like I say, all the scaffolding essentially is being constructed as we speak.
And does that also apply for one more thing that the Supreme Court will be hearing arguments about next week? And that's the expansion of Medicaid or Medi-Cal here in California. Is a lot of work also going in for the preparation for that possibility?
And this has really been the biggest push, I think. You know, California has long gotten what we call a waiver from the federal government to sort of have more flexibility in how we spend Medicaid dollars. This most recent Medicaid waiver that was negotiated is 5 years and $10 billion. And the idea is that every county in California essentially has to care for the indigent. So these are people who are uninsured, don't qualify for Medicaid because there may be, quote, childless men who don't have children in the home. So they don't actually qualify for Medicaid. So what the federal government has done is given California a big chunk of money, which is now being given out to the counties, to essentially reorient their county indigent services. So, for instance, I was just in L.A. They are literally enrolling hundreds of thousands of people who right now in this very chaotic system show up in the emergency room. They have no primary care doctor. They have no regular insurance. They're essentially enrolling them in a Medicaid or Medi-Cal-like program so that in 2014, when the switch gets flipped, the flip gets switched, they'll automatically be brought into the Medicaid program. So that's really where a lot of county and state resources are going right now.
So in some things are already in motion. A lot of the scaffolding, as you put it, is being built. But all of it may or may not, the building will either come down or continue to be built based on what the Supreme Court decides.
Yeah, there are just a couple other things that have affected adults as well that I think some people might not know about. So, for instance, there's a no copay for preventive services that's gone into effect. No lifetime caps, which has been a big deal for people who have good insurance, but then came to realize when they got very sick that there was an actual cap on how much their insurance company would pay out. And the other thing is there's no rescissions anymore. I don't know if you remember that, right? A couple of years ago, we all were reporting about these insurance companies that would go back and find some error that you made in your insurance application and rescind your policy, take it away after you had incurred a significant amount of costs.
So all of those are now in effect as well.
Yeah, okay. And many other things, but we can come back to that.
All right. Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED's California Report. She'll stay with us during the hour so that if our listeners have calls about specific things that are now in place or will be in place, Sarah will be able to respond to those. But let's turn now to the legal arguments and this extraordinary 3-day hearing that will begin next week before the United States Supreme Court. Joining us for this part of our discussion, Vikram Amar. He is professor of law and associate dean for academic affairs at the University of California Davis School of Law. Vic, good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Ilya Soman joins us as well. He's associate professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law in Arlington, Virginia. Professor Soman, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start Vic Amar, if you would, please, on the unusual nature of this three-day hearing. It's being divided up in the various arguments that the court is going to hear. And they're going to start out with what seems like a question that I didn't even realize was up for grabs here, which is whether or not the court can even rule on it, right? Because there's this question about whether or not suits can be filed or challenges can be made before penalties actually go into effect. So start us out by telling us what the court is going to hear about on the first day of the hearing.
Sure. As you point out, Dave, there are a lot of issues that the court is going to take up, and that's one of the reasons that it allowed such a long time for the argument. One of the preliminary issues is whether a challenge to a federal tax can take place before the tax is actually collected. There's this federal statute called the Anti-Injunction Act that says when you're challenging something that constitutes a federal tax, you have to wait until the tax has been collected and then seek a refund rather than try to prevent the government from collecting it in the first place. And as Ms. Varney pointed out, the mandate provision that requires everybody to procure health insurance, else pay some money into the federal treasury, that doesn't kick in until 2014. So there's a question about whether a challenge to that provision is yet ripe, it would be the legal term. I really hope the court does not end up kind of dodging the challenge on that basis, because as Ms. Varney pointed out, states really need to know whether this thing is going to go live in 2014, and they got to do all the prep work. My gut tells me that the court will find a way to reach the merits, that they won't get hung up on this preliminary threshold issue, but it's a non-trivial one.
And Ilya Soman, what's interesting about this is that the two sides agree on this, right? Both the Obama administration and those challenging the law agree that they want the court to get to the merits and not punt. Is that correct?
Yes, that is right. They both want a decision, I think, for precisely the reason Professor Amar said, that both the states and also many private parties need to know what's actually going to be happening with this law over the next couple of years so they can plan ahead. I think for a long time, numerous lower courts had all rejected this argument that the Anti-Injunction Act bars the lawsuit, but one lower court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, did accept this argument. I think even if the Supreme Court agrees with the Fourth Circuit, that may not mean that the suit can't go forward, because usually the general view is that the Anti-Injunction Act applies only to individual taxpayers challenging things that might be taxes. But in this lawsuit, we also have 26 state governments as plaintiffs. Now, the Fourth Circuit dismissed a lawsuit by the state of Virginia on a different procedural ground, but I think it's unlikely that the Supreme Court is going to rule both that private plaintiffs can't go forward because of the Anti-Injunction Act and that states cannot sue because of the technical legal theory of standing, which we can talk about if you are interested.
Well, before we pursue that further, let's get to day two, because that's really the heart of the discussion, which is the question of the individual mandate, which has been so debated ever since the law was passed 2 years ago. And this gets us into the question of the Commerce Clause, which says that Congress can pass laws that regulate things that have to do with the economy and that have national consequence. Vic Amar, give us sort of a Commerce Clause 101 about why that would apply in the case of something like healthcare.
Sure. And before I do that, let me kind of underscore something that was implicit in your description. The challenge to the individual mandate provision is not one grounded in personal liberty per se, even though that might be kind of the objection people have. It's a question of whether the federal government in particular has enumerated power under the Constitution to enact this measure. The challengers to the act don't, for example, take issue with the state of Massachusetts's power to impose a mandate as they have done in Romney Care. So this case before the Supreme Court is all about federalism. That is, what powers the federal government as distinguished from the state governments enjoy. And there are three bases on which the federal government is asserting that it has the power to impose this mandate, enact it. One is the Commerce Clause, another is the tax power, and then the third is the so-called necessary and proper power, which is kind of an auxiliary power that allows Congress to have the means to implement otherwise permissible ends that the Constitution gives to Congress. I think the Commerce Clause is probably the meatiest of the three grounds, at least that's the way it's been litigated so far. And the idea would be thus: if Congress has the power to prohibit insurance companies from discriminating on the basis of pre-existing conditions, and everyone agrees that it does, and if Congress has the power to force healthcare providers to provide services even to people who cannot pay, and I think everyone agrees that Congress does, then Congress has the auxiliary power to eliminate free riders who would have an incentive to not get insurance, but wait rather until they get sick or until they're injured. And the appropriate way that Congress has decided to eliminate the free rider problem is to require people to procure insurance, else pay money into the Treasury. So it's really the regulation of the insurance companies and the healthcare providers that kind of drives the economic sensibility of imposing a mandate on the individual consumers.
And Ilya Suman, come back on the other side, because I know you are sympathetic to those who feel that the Commerce Clause doesn't provide justification for the individual mandate.
Well, let's start with first principles. Professor Maher is certainly right that the challenge here is that this is outside of Congress's powers, and from a technical legal point of view, it's not a matter of individual liberty. But as the Supreme Court said in a unanimous decision just last year, restrictions on federal power in the Constitution are there to protect the liberty of the individual as well as the autonomy of state governments. I would also challenge the view that you expressed that what the Commerce Clause says is that Congress has the authority to regulate things that have to do with the national economy. By that standard, of course, they could regulate pretty much anything, because anything we do, or in this case choose not to do, has at least some effect on the national economy. But the Commerce Clause doesn't actually say that. What the Commerce Clause actually says is that Congress has the power to regulate commerce among the several states, and not having health insurance is not commerce, and it's not interstate either. It's true it does have some effect on interstate commerce, but the same can be said for pretty much any decision not to do anything. If I choose to spend my time doing this radio interview instead of shopping at a store during the same period of time, that affects commerce. If I choose to spend an hour sweeping rather than working, that affects commerce, and so on. So there is no general power that the federal government has to impose any regulations it wants, so long as they affect interstate commerce. Rather, the Commerce Clause, while broad in some ways, is narrower than that.
Yeah.
Professor Maher mentions the problem of free riding. It's true. This is somewhat of a problem, although it's actually a relatively small problem in the context of the overall healthcare system. But there are many ways that Congress can address this without claiming this virtually unlimited power to impose any mandate that might have some kind of commercial effect. There are lots of ways to address this. Some of them are within Congress's power. This one is not.
Well, let's pursue this question then about what sort of the federal government has the power to do, because those are interesting points, Vikram Maher, about what constitutes commerce. And one of the reasons why I phrased it, and correct me, please, both of you, if I'm not correct about this, but in one of the precedents that's been cited in this is the case that had to do with guns being near schools. And the Supreme Court said that wasn't a federal role, because A, it wasn't economic, and B, it was local. So help me understand where it applies and where it doesn't.
Well, it's true that the 10th Amendment to the United States kind of makes clear that Congress doesn't have the power to do anything it wants to. And the case you mentioned, which is called Lopez in 1995, was a signal by the Supreme Court that there are limits to what Congress can do. In that case, Congress made it a federal crime to possess a gun near a school and tried to sell that on the theory that guns near schools affect the education that takes place in the schools, and that affects the caliber of the graduates, and that affects the productivity of the workforce, and that affects the national GDP. And the Supreme Court said, you know, that house that Jack built reasoning is simply too attenuated. And if you play that game where just because some local activity when aggregated has an effect on some national market, then I think Professor Solomon is right. That means that there really is no limit to what Congress could do under the 10th Amendment. But I think the real question is, okay, where should the limits be? And is this act, the Affordable Care Act, remotely like the Gun-Free School Zone Act in what Congress was trying to do? And importantly, in terms of the attenuation between what Congress is regulating and the national economy. There's really not much attenuation between the regulation of the healthcare insurers saying they can't prohibit people from getting insurance on the basis of pre-existing conditions and the free rider problem that otherwise would ensue that Congress is responding to. So I do think that in Lopez, the court made clear that there are limits. I just don't think this case remotely falls on that side of the line. And indeed, some analysts have pointed out that because the Supreme Court had decided cases like Lopez, and there was another case called Raich, the medical marijuana case a number of years later, where the court upheld Congress's power to prohibit local possession or manufacture of marijuana, even if it was being used for home medicinal purposes, the fact that the Supreme Court has already struck down some federal laws means that it doesn't have to strike this one down in order to send the message that there are limits. So I just don't think this case really resembles the Gun-Free School Zone Act case in any big, relevant, big-picture sense.
Ilya Sorin, do you think it does resemble that the gun case?
It probably won't surprise you to learn that, yes, I do think it resembles it for the following reason. In the Gun-Free School Zones case, the government had all sorts of evidence that possessing guns near schools does actually have all kinds of effects on the national economy through education, also, by the way, through facilitating the sale of drugs in schools, which is what was going on with Mr. Lopez himself. But the court said that wasn't enough to regulate this under the Commerce Clause, not because there wasn't an economic effect, but rather because carrying a gun is not in and of itself economic activity, right? It's simply possessing an object in a particular area. Similarly, not having health insurance is also not in and of itself economic activity. It does have economic effects, but so does carrying a gun in a school zone. Now, Professor Maher talks about attenuation. I think attenuation is a sort of a little bit in the eye of the beholder, but the chain of reasoning justifying this act, I think, is at least as lengthy as the one in Lopez. So what they're saying, if you don't buy health insurance, you might get sick later, and if you get sick later, you might not have enough money to pay for your own treatment, and then Congress has enacted a law saying that you would have to be treated anyway, and so then that will have effects on the incentives of insurance companies, which in turn might undermine other parts of this law. So there's at least four or five links in that chain. Whether that's more or less than the number of links in the chain in Lopez, you know, perhaps that's a matter of opinion, but it's certainly not obvious that the reasoning here is you know, more direct or less attenuated than in Lopez. In any event, the key point is not really attenuation, but whether this is economic activity. There are various ways in which possessing guns in school zones can have actually pretty direct effects on a national economy, but that wasn't enough for the court to say that Congress can ban it.
We're coming up on a break, but I just want you to list each of you a couple of names for me, because we'll come back and talk about this further. But who are you keeping your eyes on in terms of the pivotal role that certain justices may play? Ilya Sorin, who are you most going to be watching over the next the beginning of next week?
Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts, who I think are the most likely swing voters.
And Vic Amar.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that Justice Thomas will vote to strike the law down because he's on record saying he thinks that a lot of laws Congress has passed in the last 60 years go too far under the Commerce Clause. And I think the four more so-called liberal justices will clearly vote to uphold it. So the four kind of votes to watch would be Kennedy and Roberts, and then a little bit less important but still important, Scalia and Alito.
We'll come back and talk more about what to watch for in the week ahead, and also talk more about what's in place and what will happen if the scaffolding, as Sarah Varney described it, comes down. We'll talk about all of that when we come back, and we'll take your calls too. Join us at 866-733-6786. What questions do you have about where things stand now and about the legal arguments before the United States Supreme Court? 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, healthcare reform, as it goes before the United States Supreme Court on Monday, where there will be 3 days of extraordinary hearings. Hasn't happened like this since 1966, when the Supreme Court considered the Voting Rights Act. We welcome your calls and questions about the legal arguments that the justices will be hearing at 866-733-6786. Reporter Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED's California Report, is with us as well. If you have questions about what's actually in law right now, what is in place here in California, what is still to come, if you have questions or concerns about that, we'll try to provide answers to that too. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and add your comment there as well. I want to pick up on where we left off just for a moment more on the justices to watch and ask you both each about Chief Justice Roberts and where he's likely to be on this. I know it's impossible to know for sure, but some of the reading that I've done indicates that he is not likely to want to be the fifth vote, that the Roberts Court has been about trying to build consensus where consensus is possible. Ilias, I mean, where do you see Chief Justice Roberts wanting to kind of manage how this decision comes about?
So if I knew the answer to that question with any certainty, I could potentially win a lot of money betting on it. The honest answer is that I don't know for sure what he's going to do. But here is my conjecture. I think it's possible he'll vote to uphold the law, but I think if he does so, he would want to vote on it on some basis that would not give Congress a blank check to enact virtually any other mandate that they might want to do. And the federal government has offered various reasons why they claim, well, this is a special case, it's not like other mandates. The problem is that when you look closely at those reasons, they tend to fall apart under close inspection. So the one most often given is that everybody will use health care at some point in their lives. That may be true, but notice the shift of emphasis from health insurance to health care. The same tactic can be used to justify any other mandate. For instance, you can be required to purchase broccoli on the grounds that although not everyone eats broccoli, everybody does take part in the market for food, which is even harder to avoid, I think, than the market for health care. So I think the case with all the swing voters really is likely to come down to this question: can the government articulate a theory under which this mandate is a special case rather than a blank check to enact virtually any other mandate that the federal government might want to do, and whether the justices are persuaded by that theory or not.
And Vic Amar, on how you see the prospects for how John Roberts will come down on this, and perhaps Anthony Kennedy as well.
Well, those are the two key votes. It's unlikely that Roberts and Kennedy would vote to strike it down, and the three more conservative justices wouldn't join them. It's also important, though, to note that Justice Scalia has written an opinion that recognizes pretty broad congressional powers under the Necessary and Proper Clause in that medicinal marijuana case I mentioned earlier, Raich. I'm not sure how any of those three will vote. I think kind of the consensus among court observers is that the court is more likely to uphold this law than strike it down. But, you know, there may be a little bit of a political slant to the people who teach in law schools and who watch the Supreme Court. I guess I would say I hope that if they strike it down, they do so not on a 5-4 basis. Because if it's, you know, the five Republican appointees who vote to strike it down, it will remind a lot of people, I think, of some of the problems with Bush versus Gore, and it'll erode the line between constitutional law and partisan politics. So I hope that whatever they do, there's some member of the court who is appointed by a president of the opposite party voting kind of against partisan interest, if you will.
Vic Amar at the University of California Davis School of Law, joining us with Ilias Somin, who's an associate professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. Let's go to our calls and hear what people have to say about this question before us. Paul joins us first in Morgan Hill. Paul, go ahead.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Great. Okay. So in California, we are mandated to buy auto insurance, and I didn't have a problem with that. I saw it as a broad common good. Obviously, I feel the same way about a national health care. So if we can be mandated to buy auto insurance, what's the difference between that and health insurance?
Paul, thanks. It's a question, Ilias Somin, we hear frequently. How are they different?
The big difference is this. One is the state government. The other is the federal government. The federal government is limited to a list of enumerated powers under the federal constitution. The state governments are not. Now, you may say, well, from the standpoint of individual liberty, you know, the imposition is just as great, whether it's the states or the federal government. That's true to some degree, but with the states, we have the power of exit. If state laws get very onerous, then people can and often do move to other states. This is one of the reasons, actually, why, I'm sorry to say, the state of California has been losing population to other states for the last several years, is taxes and some of its other laws are quite onerous compared to those of its neighbors. By contrast, it's far more difficult to leave the country entirely if the federal government gets to impose onerous mandates.
And to Peter, next in Santa Clara. Peter, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I've been wondering all along, and I hope you can answer this for me. Everybody seems to put this in terms of a mandate, but isn't there a different point of view, which is that it's simply a tax, which says that, you know, you can choose to buy insurance or not. That's your own decision. But if you choose not to, then we're going to tax you. And if you put it that way, then it's no different from any other tax that the federal government seems to impose somewhat arbitrarily.
Great question, Peter. Vikamar?
Yeah, and that, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the alternative bases on which the federal government is arguing that this law can be upheld. It is true that you can avoid procuring health insurance provided you just pay money into the federal treasury. This is administered by the Internal Revenue Service. You pay the money on your tax return. The counterargument, and I'm not sure I buy it, is that, you know, when Congress and the President sold this law and at various points in the law, they didn't always refer to this as a tax, but rather a penalty. My view is that if it's a tax, then it doesn't really matter what Congress calls it. The Constitution itself refers to taxes a lot of different ways. But politically, the federal government, I think, has been reluctant to lead with this argument and instead has kind of used the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause kind of more out front.
Ilyasan, do you agree that the argument is stronger on the tax side if you look at it that way?
No, I think it's weaker, and this is actually one of the very few areas of close to consensus among the lower courts. Of the 16 lower court judges who have considered this constitutional tax argument, 15 of them have rejected it. Hmm. And it's not just a matter of what they said it was, although President Obama did very clearly say that it's not a tax in some of his public statements. It's a question of that if you agree that this is a tax, then pretty much any mandate that's where the punishment for violating is a monetary fine can be a tax as well. So by this argument, a fine for jaywalking would be a tax.
Yeah.
Yes, at some level you do have a choice, but with any criminal law, you can say you have a choice. You have a choice of either paying a fine or obeying the law. You have a choice of either going to prison or obeying the law if prison is the punishment. So, you know, the fact that it's collected by the Internal Revenue Service, that's interesting, but I don't think that the agency of government that collects the money determines whether it's a tax or not. If the IRS collected the jaywalking fine, that wouldn't make that a tax. So the federal government might well win this case, but I think if they do so, the by far more likely ground is either the Commerce Clause or the Necessary and Proper Clause.
Peter, thanks for the call. Phil is next in Burlingame. Phil, go ahead. You're on.
Hi. You know, this kind of confuses me because there's Medicare and Medicaid, which are federally mandated, you know, government programs which take money out of people's paychecks and income tax in order to support, you know, health insurance, and Social Security seems very similar. Could your guest distinguish why this is any different from Medicare and Medicaid?
Phil, thanks for the question. Vikamar, and then I want to bring Sarah Varney back into this about the way in which these programs, Medicaid in particular, can differ state by state. But Vic, can you respond to Phil's question?
The challengers would point out that Medicare and Social Security are truly tax programs where your taxes are docked, your salary is docked, you pay taxes, and the federal government procures the service on your behalf. But it does raise a big and very important question, and that is, you know, if it's okay for the government to collect money from all of us and then buy insurance on our behalf, is it really that different from a federalism point of view to tell us to buy it ourselves? Relatedly, Professor Soman, I think, like all the other challengers, points out that, well, this is, you know, the decision not to purchase health care is not activity. It's not economic activity. It's a decision not to engage in economic activity. But would people really feel different if Congress rewrote the law to say, okay, if you don't have insurance, you might be contagious because you're not getting good health care. Therefore, you can't enter into any place of business because we're worried you might infect somebody, or you can't enter any public road because we don't want you to get hurt and we have to pay for it. Those would be economic activities. And why would we want Congress to have to write the law that way if this is essentially the same thing?
Phil, thanks for the call. Let me ask Sarah Varney a question on this that's related to the Medicaid or Medi-Cal expansion, because one thing that confuses me is the degree to which these are different. Medicare is consistent across all 50 states, right? But Medicaid, in the case of California, Medi-Cal, as it's called, can vary. We can do different things. And will the new law affect that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Medicare is wholly administered by the federal government and paid for by the federal government. Medicaid is a partnership between the states and the federal government. And in California, we collect about 50 cents on the dollar from the federal government for everything that we pay out. Other states do much better. The southeastern states, for instance, get a lot more money on the dollar for to administer their programs. And with that, we get a lot more flexibility. The state can decide if it's going to charge co-pays. It's going to decide how much it's going to pay doctors. So there's a lot more flexibility that the state of California and every other state has in administering the program.
Let me bring up one more thing before we get back to our calls that we haven't really discussed that, and that's what's going to come up on day three of the hearings, which is related to this question of the mandate. And that's the question of whether or not the mandate can be separated out from everything else. And the question is, as I understand it, Vic Amar, is whether or not if you say the mandate doesn't hold, does everything else fall apart? And interestingly, to me at least, both the Obama administration and the challengers say, yes, if you take away the mandate, everything goes. Tell us what's at stake there and why they're both arguing, I guess, on the same side of that question.
Well, they both could be arguing on the same side because they actually agree that the mandate is the centerpiece, is the linchpin of the whole act structure. It might also be that they both want to elevate the stakes so that the Supreme Court can't really try to split the baby and offer some kind of a compromise, although I think striking down the mandate and then leaving certain portions of the act intact would not really be much of a compromise. But the real question in all severability matters, and this is the question is whether the mandate can be severed or lopped off from the rest of the statute, is whether Congress would have passed the act even if it knew that the mandate provision would be excised. And it's ultimately a question of congressional intent. My read is that Congress probably would not have passed at least a lot of portions of the act, including perhaps the ban on pre-existing condition discrimination. But the court will reach this severability question if and only if it finds that the mandate lacks a federal authority behind it.
I see. So it would come only if it makes that determination. And Ilya Sohman, what's your view on that? Because for it all to fall would require the court to go further, right? And in some ways be kind of an act of judicial activism, wouldn't it? If you say we're not going to take away this one thing, we're going to take away all of it.
So not necessarily, because as Professor Amar pointed out, one of the legal tests for severability is whether the act as a whole would have been passed but for this provision. Many laws actually have what are called severability clauses, which say if one part is struck down, the rest stays, right? That clearly signals Congress's intent that they want to keep the other parts even if some one part is invalidated as unconstitutional. This act does not have any such clause, right, even though it has all sorts of other details in it. Now, that said, I think there's actually somewhat less agreement on this issue than you and Professor Amar suggest, because while the federal government does concede that some other parts of the law would have to fall if the mandate is struck down, they don't concede that the entire law would have to. And in fact, they have a fairly complicated argument they put forward suggesting that maybe you would have to have case-by-case litigation on the other parts of the act to see whether they're closely enough connected to mandate or not. So ultimately, I think if the court strikes down the mandate, it is very likely that they will say that there are some other parts of the law, such as the pre-existing conditions requirement, that are so closely tied into the mandate that they really don't make sense sort of standing alone. But there may be many other parts of the law which are not that closely tied to the mandate and which the court will say can stay. I think actually that intermediate kind of option is perhaps more likely than government. Either they're saying that the entire law stands or falls with the mandate, or alternatively, they're saying that the mandate falls alone and all the rest would stay in place. And I don't think it would be judicial activism necessarily in any of those options, because it's sort of a complex task for the court to try to determine, well, what was Congress trying to do, or what is sort of the structure of this law in the absence of a mandate, and whether it makes sense to say that Congress would have enacted it without it.
Vic, go ahead.
Remember, this is a behemoth law that has, you know, thousands of provisions. So it's certainly the case that not all the provisions are interlinked with each other, but the mandate is tied to a lot of the really important provisions of this act, the provisions for which people know the act.
Some emails coming in. Let's see if we can get through a couple of these in short order. Richard writes in, after the arguments have all been made, what's the approximate date when the Supreme Court would actually announce its decision? Sometime this summer, right?
Yeah, it's actually Silman. Yes, most likely in June.
And Colin writes in, it's interesting that Professor Soman would note participation in the market for broccoli, because that's the there is one case that has to do with something like this. It's Wickard versus Filburn. I'll stop with the email there and you can fill us in, Professor Soman. But this has to do with the question of how much wheat you could grow, right? So why is that particular question relevant?
It's relevant, but the case of Wickard versus Filburn is actually very different from the current case. Wickard was a 1942 case where the Supreme Court ruled that you can use the commerce power to restrict how much wheat a farmer can grow on his land, even if, as in this case, the wheat is not sold in interstate commerce. However, the Wickard case, or the law in the Wickard case, did not require anybody to purchase anything. In addition, the law was limited to commercial farm operations, which Mr. Filburn, the defendant in that case, was a commercial farmer. Now, to be honest, I'm not a fan of the Wickard versus Filburn decision. I think it has lots of problems, but it's very easily distinguishable from the present case. And indeed, the Supreme Court itself, in the Lopez case that we talked about earlier, they described Wickard as a decision that deals with economic activity and distinguished it from the situation in Lopez itself, the Gun-Free School Zones Act, on that basis. And you can distinguish it also from this case on the same basis. The real analog would be if the law in Wickard had required people who were not commercial farmers to go and buy wheat, or perhaps to go and grow wheat or something like that.
And Alan,
this is Vic, because I think it's a really important point. I think it's true that Wickard technically involved a law that limited the amount of wheat a farmer could grow, and the court upheld that limit. But the reasoning of the court in Wickard was it's okay to limit the wheat that he wants to grow and use for personal consumption, because wheat that he is growing is wheat that he is not buying. So the court said that it's okay for Congress to essentially push him into the demand curve for wheat, because it wanted to promote more consumption and purchase of wheat, and therefore limit the amount of wheat that people can grow on their own. It's true, as Professor Soman says, in a lot of these cases, the Supreme Court uses the phrase economic activity. But it just as easily could have used the term economic matters. I think the real question is whether the emphasis should be on activity or on economic. So in the Gun-Free School Zone Act case, the Lopez case, possession of a gun near a school was simply not economic. It's not the fact that it was activity or not. The question is whether it's economic activity. And the decision whether to procure health insurance or instead be a free rider is an economic decision.
Vic Amar at University of California, Davis School of Law, joining us along with Ilya Soman, Associate Professor of Law at George Mason University School of Law. Alan writes in this question, what are insurance companies doing in preparation for new regulations? I've had recent experience where a major insurance company declined to cover my son and his wife because he takes medication. What sort of work, Sarah Varney, are insurance companies now doing to get ready for what they will have to cover?
Well, I think to the professor's point that we have on the phone, that all these companies are trying to prepare for 2014. So their actuaries are very busy trying to estimate what are their risk pools going to look like in 2014. So I would say that if somebody's experiencing something right now, it's probably a reflection of something that was planned 6 months to a year ago at the insurance company, in terms of them looking at their books and deciding what kind of risk they can take or not. I think it's certainly true that there's been some evidence that the insurance companies certainly are kind of positioning themselves themselves to make sure they have the healthiest pool as they move into 2014. You're seeing a lot of advertising towards young, healthy people to try and get those folks in before 2014. It's hard to know this person's specific situation. But it's certainly true that these pre-existing condition exclusions are still in effect.
And to what extent, Ilya Soman, does the court take into account, or is it just not legally relevant, the work that's being done right now? In other words, does the court consider whether or not, as Sarah Varney was describing in our initial discussion, that people are putting a lot of work and resources into building this up so that they're ready for 2014? Does the court think about what will happen if this all goes away, or is that just not a relevant legal question?
So as a pure legal matter, it's not supposed to be relevant, except maybe to some technical standing issue that we can talk about. As a practical matter, though, I think there is a lot of evidence that sort of real-world considerations do impinge on the justices. So I think if this were a law that everyone or almost everyone agreed was a good idea and it had overwhelming support, I think it's highly unlikely that the court would strike it down. Even if the legal arguments against it were quite strong, as I think they are, given that the law is highly controversial and the mandate in particular is very unpopular, the court has more wiggle room than it might in a case where the law had very broad, strong support. That doesn't mean, I think, that the court would strike it down merely because, you know, it's unpopular, but the court is aware of its political environment, and they realize that if they believe that this is unconstitutional, then they can strike it down without generating the kind of truly massive political backlash that would really damage the court, although obviously some people would be very unhappy.
Let me add one thing, because I think Professor Soman is right about all that. But this law, even though controversial, was the subject of huge political national campaigns. Congressional elections, presidential elections were waged on it. This is not like the Gun-Free School Zone Act that was struck down in Lopez. This is a big deal, and this is something that the American people at election time have looked at and taken into account in deciding who they want to elect. So that's an argument that the court doesn't need to step in, that the political process takes care of itself and things like this.
Let's go next to David. Professor Soman, go ahead.
Yeah, so yes, this was mentioned in the campaign. Ironically, however, the man who won the last presidential campaign was the man, Barack Obama, who specifically came out against having an individual mandate. And indeed, when Hillary Clinton proposed it in 2008, he said that trying to solve health insurance problems by an individual mandate was like trying to solve homelessness by requiring people to buy a house. If you want to look at the result of the 2008 election, at least in a Democratic primary, they voted for the guy who said he wouldn't enact an individual mandate.
So, Vikamarv, since we're staying on this for a moment, let me just give you one more beat on this. Why would the administration seemingly want to have this litigated right now?
Well, I think for a number of reasons. One, they want to, you know, get it resolved so that this thing can go up and running in 2014 if need be. I don't think they're trying to play games. But they also understand that, you know, if this is struck down during the summer, that, you know, a lot of political observers might think that that's not a terrible thing for the Democrats because it will take this issue off the table. The question of repeal of the act is no longer a big deal for the Republicans. And it can also, again, if it gets struck down on a 5-4 kind of party line vote, then it can be kind of an energizer for the Democratic base. But I just want to make clear my point earlier was not that the American people have overwhelmingly approved this. It's that this law has been looked at and is out there for the American people. So this is not a law that kind of stole upon the Congress or an unsuspecting American public. Everybody knows about this mandate provision and can take it into account. And that's a reason why court may feel it doesn't have to intervene.
Let's get in a couple of more calls. David next in Walnut Creek. David, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. What happens to the funds that are collected if you don't buy insurance? Do people who don't buy insurance get any benefit? Because that, to me, would tell us whether it's a tax or a penalty. Because Social Security is constitutional.
Do you mean, right? David, the what would happen with the penalty money if you don't get insurance? What happens to that money that the government collects?
You just called it a penalty, but that's the question. Do people who don't buy insurance under the policy get any sort of benefit? Like, are they enrolled in any, do they have any flow of benefit from the taxes that they are paying in lieu of, you know, having medical coverage.
Yeah. David, thanks. Sarah Varney, can you help us with that?
The short answer is no, that you don't get a specific kind of policy or anything that comes your way. What the administration would say is that you get the opportunity, if you are in a car accident, to go to a hospital and have somebody actually save your life. So that's essentially what they're trying to recoup, are all those billions of dollars that the federal government pays out to hospitals and states around the country for people who show up at the emergency room and have no care, have no insurance plan.
Just have a moment for one more question that I'll read and use it as a way, Professor Soman and Professor Amar, to sum up. This person writes in, why is some kind of national health care assistance so different than Social Security? Most everyone agrees Social Security was necessary. For the record, I oppose President Obama's health care reform, but I do think some sort of national health care program is necessary. So use that as a way of describing what's different about this and why you think the mandate is not applicable. Professor Soman first, please.
Yeah, so some sort of national health care program might be very similar to Social Security, but this one is not, because the legal arguments behind it do in fact amount to an argument for giving Congress virtually unlimited power to impose other mandates. If you accept this mandate on the grounds that not having health insurance has an economic effect, well, pretty much any other activity we choose to engage in or not engage in also has economic effects. As I said, if you choose to spend an hour sweeping, you haven't used that time to work or do something productive. So there are many different ways to reform healthcare. Some of them are constitutional. This one, I think, mm-hmm. is not.
Let me hold you there. Vic Amar, last word.
Well, I think technically, you know, a Social Security tax is different, but I think the question raises the larger issue of, you know, how formalistic are we going to be? What's federalism all about? And is Congress really trying to push the envelope here, or is it doing something that clearly affects the national economy? I mean, if you think that possessing guns near schools has the same effect on the economy, both in terms of proximity and a dollar amount, as the free riders on the healthcare system, then you strike this law down. If you don't, then I think you'd uphold it.
We'll leave it there. Vic Amar, UC Davis School of Law professor and associate dean for academic affairs. Vic Amar, thanks so much for being part of our program.
Always my pleasure.
And Ilya Soman, associate professor of law at George Mason University School of Law in Arlington, Virginia. Ilya Soman, thanks too for being part of our program.
Thank you very much.
And Sarah Varney, reporter for the California Report at KQED. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Tina Lorberg, Judy Campbell, and Amy Machado. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Danny Bringer is our engineer. And Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.